So this is the most real life intro I'll ever do on this podcast. As we speak, I'm in Texas, deep in Texas, in the middle of nowhere. And I am about to knock on the door of someone who probably doesn't want to talk to me. And I think sometimes people may get the impression from listening to me that I'm like gutsy or whatever, you know, your typical journalist who like, but I'm not. And I hate doing this. And I'm like driving around a couple of times just to sort of work up the nerve. This is a person who has experienced a horrible tragedy. I texted her and never really heard back. So I don't know if she's willing to talk or not. And I'm not a fan of the awkwardness of it all, at all. But I'm gonna go do it because I know I have to. Because, you know, I gotta park the car. I'm going to pull up. I'll probably get yelled at. And then hopefully I don't get shot. And I'll let you know what happened. So, but just if you're like a journalist and you're a young journalist and you think this shit gets easy, it does not. Most certainly does not. So, here we go. Okay, I'm back. So I walked up to the house and there were a bunch of people doing tar paper on the roof. And I approached with a book in my hand and could tell nobody was home. And then I turned to my right and there was another door attached to a warehouse right next door, like someone's warehouse that they owned on the property. And this is what the door said. I'm not joking. It said, "Praying is a good way to meet Jesus. Trespassing on my property is faster." My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Gabrielle Calise, the Tampa Bay Times nostalgia reporter. Yep, you heard that right. She covers nostalgia, which definitely has me nostalgic. This is episode number 260. Let's sing some yay.
Dad, your podcast sucks, and you smell like vinegar and cottage cheese.
All right, Gabrielle, first of all, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it very much. I've probably had about 250 episodes of this podcast, and I have had writers from all walks of life. I've had rappers, I've had singers, I've had comedians. I don't think I've ever had someone whose literal beat is nostalgia. You are in your, I'm guessing, mid-20s?
Yeah.
Most people in their mid-20s aren't that nostalgic. Like, I feel like I'm 49. When you get this age, you become much more nostalgic because you're like, music of Madonna, whatever, you know, I wish I could hear a Hall & Oates song, whatever. Oh, that movies today aren't as good as blah, blah, blah. Like that is what your life becomes as you get older. You become a walking bowl of stupid nostalgia where your kids just say, please shut the fuck up. It's not better than. You're at an age where I would think nostalgia doesn't mean that much to you. So why are you covering nostalgia?
Oh my gosh, nostalgia means, you know, it can mean anything to anyone. Really what it is it's emotions, right? It's feelings that we have about a place or memories or, you know, things that used to be there, food we liked to eat. You can be nostalgic for stuff that you're going through right now. It kind of became like a good bucket to deal with a lot of these like history themed things that I just kept finding myself gravitating back towards. And I'll kind of get to, I guess, how I ended up in this position. But even though I have not lived that long, I think the whole time that I've been here, I've kind of just been like, I need to record this. I need to like, you know, journal this. I need to process how I'm feeling. I need to think about the memories that I'm going to have, you know, before I've even finished making them. I don't know, but it's something that I think when you're talking about a place like the Tampa Bay region, you have so many people who all come here and they might not even have been here that long. But reporting on nostalgia could mean just like giving them an explanation for this area that has all sorts of remnants of stuff that is here from the past. We're kind of like this big area made up of a lot of smaller areas, Frankenstein together. And it's not always cohesive and it doesn't always make sense. So having someone to kind of walk you through that area and explain why it is the way that it is and why it feels the way that it feels, I think is helpful. I hope is helpful. And even though like I am a lot younger than a lot of the people who are reading the paper or, you know, coming to our website. I think sometimes it's nice to come to it with fresh eyes. And the nice thing about it too is like, it's not about me, it's about the people who, you know, I'm writing about and the people that are going to read it. So as long as I can be a vessel for their nostalgia, hopefully that means I'm doing my job well.
All right, so you, I want to dive right into this thing. You wrote a story a couple of years ago called We Bought Hot Dogs for the Buns, and which I really loved. It was about these women who in the 90s made a business out of selling roadside hot dogs in their bikinis.
Yeah, specifically the thong bikinis. That's what made everyone mad.
Right. So they're basically standing on the side of the road selling hot dogs in thong bikinis. And your lead was, it's a late summer afternoon in Valerie Workman's Pinellas Park living room. TMZ flickers on mute as her five dogs howl. Sitting crisscross on her couch, she unzips a duffel bag stuffed with 30-year-old stripper thongs. It's been years since Workman, now 55, has seen some of these items. By the time she gets to the bottom of the bag, her couch is covered in ancient bedazzled panties. But she hasn't unearthed what she was actually looking for. There are plenty of relics from her nights as a dancer, but nothing from her stint as a hot dog girl. In the early 1990s, roads in St. Petersburg, Pinellas Park, and Largo were peppered with hot dog carts staffed by women in teabags, thong bikinis. Workman, who left dancing to peddle Italian sausages and sodas, claimed she was the first. It's been decades since she packed up her cart and went back to dancing, but Workman still wonders, what happened to the hot dog girls? I'm all about this story. I freaking love these kinds of stories. Let's go a little step by step. Number one, what brought you to writing about women in bikinis selling hot dogs in the 1990s?
Basically, I stumbled into sort of like a series of stories about the more salacious parts of Tampa's history. So it started with these conversations I would have with our Sunday editor when I was working the Sunday shift about just Tampa and why it's just such a weird place. And of course that started with, well, why does Tampa have so many strip clubs? So I wrote a story about that, which turns out like, you know, we don't have the most and we don't have the craziest, but we have this reputation and why is that? And then that led to, okay, well, what's the deal with that, you know, strip club on Dale Mabry that has a giant spaceship on the roof of it? And so that turned out to be a really interesting history story about architecture and, you know, these like lost prefabricated homes of like the 70s. And then, you know, you do a couple of these stories and you gather up like extra bits of reporting. And then, okay, I have a list of like stories about like things you didn't know about like Tampa strip club history. And at this point, my mom is like, what are you doing? Like, can you stop writing about strippers? And I'm like, no. It makes sense. Cause it's more than just like, we're being salacious to be salacious. Like these stories are stories of people who work here and stories of the landscape of the city and politics and power and money. And there's so much more to it. And so at that point, people start bringing me ideas. And our newsroom manager, Kirk, he came to me and he says, you know, you got to write about the hot dog girls. And I was like, what are the hot dog girls? Because, you know, they were in the peak of their power around the time that I was born. So this predates me, the hot dogs. And so he starts to tell me like, yeah, no, these women, they would do this and they just kind of disappeared, but it was such a thing here. And we used to have some, I would, you know, come into work and see on my way in. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to put this on my radar, the hot dog girls. And I was looking in our archives, just like reading stories of turf wars between women who were selling, you know, their hot dogs and, you know, different competitions that they would have and the people that were doing this a lot of times like had worked in Tampa strip clubs. And so I was like, well, how do you make that transition, you know, from doing that to this? And it just was fascinating to me. It was such a specific job. I love like an odd job and I love people that are really passionate about what they do, even if it's something that is like a little bit goofy. I love things that are a little bit goofy. So that's kind of how I got to this. And then I found Valerie because I was in like a Facebook spiral. I was just going through all of my favorite groups, you know, searching the Remember in Tampa When and, you know, St. Pete Memories kind of groups. And I was just like searching for the keyword, like hot dog girls. And here's this woman who used to be a hot dog girl and she's looking for the hot dog girls. And she's trying to figure out what happened to these girls that she would sell hot dogs with. And it was such a fun part of her life. And, you know, her in the present day, there's a lot of difficulties that she's facing, a lot of like personal struggles. And so for her, she was reaching for that part of her life that was so much fun. And I was like, this is the perfect, like, you know, vehicle to navigate us through this too.
You find Valerie Workman via yeah. Facebook, and then you reach out to her. Is she immediately all in on this?
Oh, totally. She's like, let's go to the park right now. And so we met at this park that she likes to go to, and she had this like zippered pouch with all these pictures. She had like her camera. And the thing that I love about this woman is like, she's just living, breathing nostalgia. Like, not only is she like, let's dive into my memories, but she was like, I brought my camera with me so the two of us can take a picture right now so we can remember this later. And you know, it was kind of a process. It took a while to like report the story out because I was doing other things, and you know, she had stuff that was going on in her life, and I was trying to find some of the other hot dog girls to see if I could speak with them. And you know, eventually I'm like, I just got to go to her house. And she, the first time that we met up, actually, she brought this VHS tape, and it was for Wiener Mania 2. And it was basically like this mud wrestling battle between two hot dog girls who had a dispute over, you know, whose territory was whose. And it was televised by like a local station. And Valerie was in this, you know, as like sort of like a background character. And so she had recorded this tape and was like, I don't have a way of us watching this, but I want to watch this with you. So I had to figure out how to get this VHS tape digitized. At first I tried to like put it into like one of the newsroom TVs that had like a VHS player in it, but it was so old and like no one used it that I broke the TV, and like the IT guy had to come and help me take it apart so I could save the tape. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like the only known record of Wiener Mania. I'm going to break this and lose the history, but it was fine. I like took it to this head shop that also does like VHS to DVD conversions, and we got the tape. And I at this point, I'm like, this woman is going to forget about me. She's going to be like, you're taking too long. I thought she was going to get sick of this process, but she was so excited. And yeah, that was the day that I went over there. And when I came over with the DVD, she was ready. And she was like, here's all of my old outfits. Some of these I made myself. Like, look how little I used to be. Look at like, here's what I used to look like on these keychains that we would print out and give to guests. And like, she was all into it. And then we just like sat on her couch and we watched Wiener Mania. And she was like pointing out things. We were laughing. She was tearing up. And she was totally, totally all in, which just made it even more fun.
All right. So two things. Number one, Costco is your answer for all digital transferring needs. Actually, that is true. And number two, the thing about nostalgia that's interesting, I feel like nostalgia isn't complete without some sadness. Like, I'm reading this story and I'm thinking throughout, well, what happened to Workman? Like, what happened to Workman? And you get to the end and you wrote, Workman has always been nostalgic. Now more than ever, she finds herself reaching for the past. After she retired from dancing in 2004, Workman worked building boats and repairing roofs. She got laid off about 6 years ago and hasn't worked since. Then in 2014, while she was driving on 54th Avenue, she was hit by a truck head on. Things haven't been the same since. She can't make a fist. She barely sleeps. Sometimes she tries to go to the beach, but mostly she stays at home. Her husband, Kevin, has been having health problems too. He recently found out he has colon cancer. 4 days after he was diagnosed, he broke his left wrist. To distract herself from the pain, Workman thinks of the hot dog girls. I've been searching forever, she said. I want to see them again. And I actually feel like it sucks, right? But the story isn't nearly as good. This is going to sound crass, but I don't know what if she's not a little broken down, like if she's still like competing in like fit competitions at 55 and she looks amazing and she's blah, 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 the nostalgia doesn't have the same power. Do you disagree with this? I just think there's more power in nostalgia when there's actually some sadness accompanied to it.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I do think that like, having that balance of like something that's just like so joyful with something that is just so heartbreaking. I mean, it was really hard to hear all the stuff that she had been through. I mean, that is what life is, right? And that is certainly something that everyone can relate to. You don't get, you know, one without the other. But also at the same time, I mean, if she was still, you know, rocking the thong bathing suits, going out and competing, I also think I would be fascinated with this woman just because she is like a really, you know, interesting individual and has a story. But I do think that with nostalgia, I mean, a lot of what we're looking at is stuff that isn't there anymore, or it isn't the way that it used to be. And my therapist always likes to remind me that like with every bit of change, there is loss. And with every bit of loss, you're grieving that. And so in a way, it's like, I mean, when you're writing about stuff that's gone and you're talking to people about memories that they had, I do think that there is going to be something that's like inherently a little bit just like bittersweet about it, at least. Yeah. And it, you know, it could be something like this where, you know, why do people reach for the great times that they used to have, or the things that used to like make them smile? Probably because they need a little bit of a distraction. Like I just did a story about this woman who, you know, made a coloring book line based on old roadside attractions. Some of them are still here, but most of them are not. And the reason why she did that is because she got laid off from her jobs and it was a pandemic and she was just having like a terrible time. And so for her, it's like, this is something that was really, really cool. And it does kind of speak to your point, I think, about, you know, nostalgia is so often like inspired, I guess, by these hard times that we go through.
Don't you think in a way, it's kind of interesting, like nostalgia is seen through rose-colored glasses. Like she remembers this glowing time of her life. Well, she doesn't remember probably the guy driving by yelling out slut in from the window, or the hot dogs falling in a puddle by accident, or, you know, like, do you have to be careful in your job not to over add in too much glow to nostalgia?
Oh, I mean, we talked about sort of, you know, some of the down points. I mean, she was like, we would see gators sometimes out there in the water. Like you certainly would have really gross dudes, you know, coming to visit and stuff. And for her, it's like, you know, at the time it was unpleasant, but she laughs at it now. And she gains that power back by telling the story the way that, you know, she wants to tell it. And I can help her do that. But certainly I think that, you know, you have to be careful because just like how I'm not writing about like current events in a way that is like, isn't everything so great and whatever. Like, no, like you're writing about the whole picture. Right. And I do think that it's important and it's good storytelling too, to, you want to get in the head of the person that you're telling the story of, but you got to take a step back and see the whole picture. And that is, I think, what makes it so fun, is sort of balancing, you know, obviously there's like the sweet parts of it. Right. And then you have to bring up like those nasty bits as well. I think that nostalgia too, it's like something that we could have easily just called this, you know, history reporter, or I'm reporting on things that are no longer here. Right. But I do think that like so much of it is like having that emotional aspect and having the people's complex feelings about the topic as well as what the topic is, right? So I definitely, in my reporting, I'm trying to get the whole picture.
All right. So I would say for the last X number of years of my life, I've always written about somewhat famous people, athletes or whatever. And when I write about them, they don't really give a shit. You know, like they don't really give a shit. You're writing about a woman who's never written about, who, and you're writing about something very personal from her life. So when the story's coming out, number one, I don't know, do you call her the night before? Do you let her know the night before? And number two, are you nervous at all that she's going to be like, well, you fucked this one up?
Oh my God. Like these types of stories are the ones that like, I get a pit in my stomach the night before and I wake up and I'm like really tight in my chest and I'm like, did I mess something up? But anytime that I'm doing something that's like this level of, you know, probing into someone's own personal history, 100%, I'm like triple fact checking that. Like it's one thing if you mess up like someone's name spelling or whatever, but like to mess up the type of story where you're getting inside someone's experience and you're walking alongside with them, like that's very serious. And so I record all the interviews, let her know that I'm doing that, take really, really good notes. And then with something like this, I think I called her actually like two or three times, but I just called her and I was like, I'm going to read back to you every single fact that I have in here. Like, right. I mean, our policy at the Times is like, we don't send, you know, stories in their entirety. Most publications don't let you do that. But I was like, do you have like an hour to just sit down? And I would like, you know, obviously check with her, like, is this like the right date? Is this the right place? But also like, I wrote about this in a way where I said that you were feeling XYZ. Is that accurate? Is there a better way I could have phrased that? Just because I definitely don't want to take any chances with something like this. And then I told her like, this is when it's coming out online and this is when it's coming out in print. And I like to send people the link to the web story when it publishes and say, here it is. I fact checked it with you. I think we should be fine. But if there's anything that I still messed up, let me know so we can get a correction before it goes into print. Just because, like, you know, something like this, where this is not a public figure, this is not someone who gets in the newspaper every day, I want to just make sure that I'm doing right by them. And for the most part, you know, no issues there, but you hit the nail on the head. It's one of those things where I'm like a mess right before something like this comes out.
Okay. So she finds out, she reads the story. Does she call you?
Oh, we were Facebook messaging and she said that she really liked it.
That's good. That's a relief, yeah. Isn't it?
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. It's just good to know that you, you nailed it and you were accurate, especially for something where you're not there. Like I, you know, certainly watched Wienermania, in its grainy VHS to DVD quality over and over again, but like I was not at that event. So, and you know, I'm not in her head. So anytime that you're like, okay, I got it, it feels, it's a big relief.
So we all have in our career, and your career is much younger than mine, like we all have moments where someone says, you screwed that one up, you missed that one. Have you had that moment yet?
Oh my God, absolutely.
What's yeah. your worst? What's your worst moment so far?
Okay, so there is this theater in St. Pete, downtown near where I live, called the Playhouse Theater. And it doesn't look as ridiculous as it used to look, but for at least a year or two, I would drive by it on my way home from going out or, you know, going to get coffee or whatever. And I was like, why do they do this? Like, why does it look like this? Because it's basically this like nice building. On the side of it, there's this gigantic like two-story mural of Marilyn Monroe. That part looks really nice. But then there's these strobe lights that they put on it and they are just blinking 24/7, super bright, super obnoxious, very unsettling. And then there were these weird, like kind of Laurel and Hardy-esque statues that were outside. And I was just like, what's the vibe here? Like, and it was for sale and it had been for sale like for a long time. It is still for sale. And I was like, I just wonder like, what, like this is a really great area for retail and businesses and whatever, like why hasn't someone purchased this yet? But also like, what is this building? And like, who chose to make it look like this as they're trying to sell it? And it turns out this building is like, has basically this long, long history, almost a century of many different lives that it's had. It's been a dinner theater. It's been a burlesque theater. It's been like, I think at one point someone said it was like a porn theater. Like there was, you know, a sports themed bar. There was like live music. There was all sorts of stuff. And so I was like, okay, now that I know what this used to be and all the different names that it had, like, let's trace sort of like how we got to this point. And I just wanted to do like, what's the deal with the Playhouse Theater? And in the 70s, it was called Papa's Dream. And it was like a nightclub for teens with sort of like a Christian angle and some disco. So I called it like a Christian teenage disco for teens, because that's, you know, how it was characterized. I talked to different people who were, you know, there. I like looked in the clips. I like read about it. I saw pictures of it. And I was like really nervous because like the longer the history is, the more you're sticking your neck out, the more room for error. But I like double checked everything, the clips, right? And I talked to this guy, Stan, who runs a prolific Facebook group called I Love St. Pete. It's really good. There's just like almost 100,000 people who are in that group probably. And he, I guess, used to perform in a band that played at Papa's Dream. And I had a great interview with him. He told me other people to talk to. He was so mad that I called it a Christian disco. He was like, no, it was rock and roll. It was this. He's like, you are wrong. You're a liar. And I'm like, other people told me that that was what they remembered it as. That was what they experienced it as. And he was so pissed. He was like, you are fake. You are a liar. And so I was like, okay, let's dial it back a little bit. And I kind of showed him like, here's where I got this from. But I was also like, if you were writing this, how would you have characterized Papa's Dream? Like, let's talk about it. And I don't even think that I ended up tweaking anything in the story. I think I just changed the subhead so it was like a little more tame. But that was a really big learning lesson because like, you know, what this place was to someone else was completely wrong for him. And he read it and he thought, I'm making stuff up. And he thought, you know, this is exactly why people don't like newspapers. This is exactly why whatever. So we had a conversation about it. I think he felt better. I'm still in the Facebook group. I've still talked to him about other stuff. But I was very worried for a minute. I was like, you know, I will never be able to drive past this like ridiculous theater again. And at the end, it's like neither one of us was really wrong, but it definitely taught me a lesson in just like the way that people can get really, really emotional about the places that they used to go to. And yeah, I don't know. I approach things a little bit differently now. I'm just a little bit more careful.
So I remember I started my career at the National Tennessean, and anytime someone questioned a story or pointed out an error, my first reaction was to hide under my desk and assume I was going to get fired. And just like this horrible fear of, you know, putting myself in a little ball. You don't seem like you get that. Do you get that too?
Oh my, I mean, I'm a very nervous person, but I am more confident in the stories that I tell now because I just fact check the shit out of everything. And anytime that I'm like even remotely nervous about something, I just want to call up the person and be like, can we go over it? And so far it's been a lot better. But from the beginning, I was like, you know, still nervous. And now it's like, I mean, sure, like errors still happen. You can still mess up a spelling or whatever. But as long as it's something that's like, you know, I'm not mischaracterizing a person or something that happened, I try to just give myself a little bit of grace and try not to let it like ruin my whole day. But definitely I've had days where I'm just like in a foul mood because I'm mad at myself for, you know, not doing the best job that I could have done.
You graduated, as I said, you graduated college in 2018. So you are certainly a generation of journalists who have come up with online first mentality, and you've come up with Twitter and you've come up with Instagram and posting stories and blah, 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 blah. You work for a newspaper, however. Does what comes out in print matter to you at all? Do you actually get a newspaper? Do you ever read a print newspaper?
I am just such an online first person. I don't get the print paper just because I used to get it, but I was living at the time in like a condo complex where it would just never arrive. It would never get there. And then I moved, and then I moved again. And like, yeah, along the way, I just don't get the print paper, but I read every single day. Pretty much all day I'm like reading, what do we have coming up on TampaBay.com? Like I like the e-newspaper, you know, just to be able to see and get those PDFs. And every time I'm in the newsroom or picking up something, because, you know, for 2 years we weren't in the newsroom, we just went back. But I would go back and I would like get like bundles of the papers, and I would catch up with how it looked, and I would see how my stories, you know, ran. And certainly every week when we're laying out the Floridian section for the Sunday paper, I'm like, please send me like the proofs because I want to read it. It's just more convenient when I'm actually like being a consumer of news to get it online. And when I do like an important story, like I want to have that and hold it. You know, I did this piece on these two divers who were like pulling bodies out of the bay when the Sunshine Skyway Bridge collapsed, and they were like trying to help out, and it was really traumatic for them. And so on the 40th anniversary, we did this huge profile on them because their story had never been told before. And I went to the printing plant and I like got the plates, and I had the plates in my bedroom because I was like, I want to have that. Like, this was a really big deal that we got to tell their story, and I wanted to like have something as a souvenir to hold on to it. But it is just like the reality that, you know, we can't print 7 days a week. And so I want to focus on like, what can I do that still does really good journalism, but is like using the platform that we have available. One of the really great things about focusing on online first is that like I can add a bunch more photos and links and embeds and videos, and like make that experience like really fun in a way that like you just can't do with print. And so I guess instead of like mourning it, I'm just really trying to embrace like what we do have, but it does suck. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat that.
Wait. So, I got to say, the story you did on the divers, which ran in May 6, 2020, the Forgotten Divers, and the subhead is two state bridge inspectors were among the first divers to recover bodies from the choppy waters of Tampa Bay. So how do their deeds go unnoticed by history? And your lead was Robert Rayola never fully left the Skyway. The 73-year-old is there when he recalls inspecting the bridge as Florida Department of Transportation diver with his friend and former coworker, Michael Betts, 66. He was there when he remembers diving off his boat in the bay with friends and bringing back stone crabs to cook with his family. It's where he went to scatter the ashes of his first wife, Nancy, in the waves next to the bridge. When his time comes, he wants to join her. And even though it haunts him, he's not been able to stop thinking about the bridge inspection turned disaster response the day the Sunshine Skyway Bridge collapsed 40 years ago this week. He still obsesses over that stormy morning he and Beth spent pulling bodies from a Greyhound bus that had crashed into the bay's choppy waters. He wants his grandchildren to know what he saw. First of all, you're a fucking really good writer. That's like really good.
Thank you.
When you were writing about people and tragedy and you were going back in time. And again, like, I do think like one of the things people have to overcome when they are young writers is people dismissing them as like, you wouldn't understand, or how could you be just, there's an assumption that younger people lack the empathy. And I went through this too, when I was your age and writing these stories, what the fuck would you know about loss? So when you're given this assignment and it's a horribly tragic, sad, nostalgic piece, how do you go about it while projecting the proper sort of level of empathy and understanding?
I don't even think that I like have thought about it like that. I think I just thought these people saw some shit and went through some stuff, and like, it's just a huge honor to be able to go with them. And so I just wanted them to trust me. I think that was like my first step, because they came to me after reading some of the other Skyway stories I had done. And
who's they?
Oh, Rob and Mike.
Okay.
So Bob was like, you know, I really want to tell, and like, you know, we want to tell you our story, but no one else has really done it justice. And there was this whole documentary that was made about the Skyway that they thought they were going to be in, and they were like briefly in it, but it didn't tell the story that they wanted to tell. You know, there had been books written about the tragedy, but they were like, this doesn't tell the whole story. This isn't right. And so they desperately, desperately wanted to be seen and to have this account told, no matter how painful that was for them. But at the same time, they were really guarded. And it's like, they didn't know who they could trust, but they wanted someone that they could trust. And so it just took a lot of time, like hanging out with them and not even like being on the record, like not recording, not taking notes, just like going to breakfast with them and other people that they, you know, hung out with, or having them come to the newsroom a couple times, you know, just being on the phone with them, and also explaining to them like my process of just, I'm not trying to get like a gotcha out of you. I'm not trying to put anything out here that you don't want out there. Like, this is how I will fact check with you. I will sit with you on the phone. I will go meet up with you, and I will read you every single thing that I'm saying that you've said, because I want to just be sure that we're doing this right. They had people that they wanted me to call that I was like, okay, I will call them. I will try to understand where this is coming from. And I just, you know, I wanted them to feel comfortable first, because again, I've never been through a tragedy like that. That's horrible. But this is something that if I had been through that, I would really, really want someone to just be patient with me.
When someone is telling a story that is this dark, this tragic, and probably this scarring in their own personal lives, is there a certain way you're supposed to go into it as a reporter so you don't fuck this thing up?
I think you have to be really open. I think you have to let them tell you what was there, and like let it unfold. And maybe they have to tell you a couple times, and each time they get more personal with you. And I think the great thing about this is like the luxury of time. Like, they came to me around Christmas time, and then this published like in May. So I had a good length to just like let it unfold and not rush them and not like pressure them to go on the record with certain things. But I really think that like, you just have to let people, you know, I guess like warm up to you. And yeah, I don't know. I really just went into this thinking like, I want to do right by them. And that's how I went into like the hot dog girl story, was like, I want to do right by them. Especially if it's something where everyone wants to talk about the Skyway. It's like the number one topic. Anytime I write a story about the Skyway, it like pops off online, and people email and they call and they have thoughts and feelings about it. So I knew this was going to be something where a lot of people were reading it. And I just thought, what is like the most sensitive that I could be here with them? And it was hard, but I do think that like, you know, we talk about like, I'm obviously like younger than some other reporters, and maybe I'm still at the beginning of my career, but a lot of times like people who are Bob and Mike's age look at me and they think my grandkids are that age, or they think like this is like a family member. And so they're just looking at me like a person and not as a journalist. And I'm just looking at them like, this could be like some guy that I'm talking to, you know, that I run into at breakfast, or that, you know, I'm not thinking about them as the divers, but I'm thinking about them as Bob and Mike. And how do I get Bob and Mike to understand that I'm just here to try to help them and help people understand them?
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, who's still home from college for winter break. So, Casey, I heard Taylor Swift redid all her albums.
Uh-huh.
You know who's awesome? That guy on TikTok.
Uh-huh.
I'm feeling hella dope. Let's get matching tats, kid.
No.
What the hell? You've been home for a while now, and I'm trying to connect with you, college kid, but nothing works.
Just because I'm 18 doesn't mean I'm into trivial stuff. Talk to me about the goods. RoyalRetros.com throwback Doug Flutie jerseys, handcrafted and perfect for the late holiday gift.
I hear Stranger Things is crazy.
Dad, stop.
Correct me if I'm wrong here. So I took my son recently to last week to a Tyler, the Creator concert. And I was like, Jesus Christ, I'm the oldest person here by a lot, right? I feel like you would rather hang out with guys like Bob and Mike than the 22-year-olds at the Tyler, the Creator concert. Am I wrong? It seems like you would.
I think it really depends. I don't know. I mean, I spend a lot of time on TikTok, and my sister is like 20, and I feel old sometimes talking to her, even though I'm 26, and like, there's not that much difference, but I think I'm in sort of like a weird year to be born. So I was born in 95, which is like, I'm on the cusp of like barely being a millennial, but like almost like a zoomer or like a Generation Z person. And I don't know. I mean, I've definitely had that experience though, because I used to love going to shows growing up in St. Pete and then in Gainesville when I was in college, and I loved it, and it was such a great community to be a part of. And then I remember right before the pandemic going to a show in Ybor and being like, wow, I feel old. Like, and just because like I wasn't dressed the way that like people who were like teens and like 20, you know, were dressing. And there's definitely like a shift in culture. But also at the same time, it's like, I just want to understand people. I think that as long as people are being like respectful, I will be in a space. I like hanging out with people that are older. I have a lot of friends who are older. I just went to a wedding of my old neighbor who is this retired flight attendant. And we, you know, we're both just like these single ladies living next to each other. Like, and we would hang out on the balcony. She'd be smoking a cigarette. I'd be telling her about like work and stuff. And when I was at her wedding, like I was the only guest that like wasn't like in their 60s. And my boyfriend pointed out, he was like, that's really cool that like you're friends with someone who's older. Very. Yeah. I didn't see her as like, she's this person who's older. I see her as like Mary, who goes to jazz clubs and is like always, you know, singing on her balcony, and we're having a great time together. Just like, I don't know. I don't know what to say here, but you can be friends with people of all ages. I think it's good as a reporter to just like blend in and sort of like chat with every person you know, because everyone has a different experience and everyone has different ideas that could turn into story ideas.
Two thoughts on this. Number one, I don't care how old you feel anywhere. You will never feel as old as I did at the Tyler the Creator concert last week. I just want to say, I tweeted out something about it. I'm at the show and I tweeted something and someone wrote back, why are you there? And I was like, oh my God. Number two, I'm all in with you. Like, I just think as journalists, you're just curious about stuff. Like, that's it. You're just curious about stuff. And it doesn't matter if you're at a Tyler, the Creator concert or talking to two guys in their 70s, you're just curious. And ultimately that's what it comes down to. And the best part of this job by far is you have this invisible license that allows you to ask people probing questions about their lives, age, status, money, background, non-factor.
I love getting to learn shit about people and be a little nosy and get to know people. And I don't know, I live right now in this condo complex that is like mostly older people, and they have shuffleboard courts in the courtyard and like a swimming pool where they all hang out and like play Madonna and I'm like sitting here working and I'm like, why am I not out there with them? And I like to talk to everyone who lives here. I like to talk to people that I like, I'm in the grocery store with. I like to just like chat with someone who I overhear something with, and maybe that's annoying to them, but I don't know. People like to be seen. And I do think that like the nice thing about like being 26 is sometimes people just like don't look at you and think like you're a scary journalist who's about to get them. They think like, oh, here's just this like young lady and she wants to chat and I want to chat too. And so I try to use that to my advantage. Like, I think a lot of people haven't met journalists, or they have an idea of what a journalist is in their mind based on like what they read or what they like see in like TV shows and movies about journalists. But most people, like when you chat with them about sort of the expectation versus like the reality, which is just me, this non-threatening person that just wants to chat, it is pretty cool because you can be a good example to them of like, you know, maybe they could adjust kind of their thinking of like what we're like as people.
I want to ask you a last question here about this story. So in the bridge story, you wrote, as he crawled into the dark bus alone, he saw passengers still trapped in their seats upside down. None had survived. It was clear this would be a revival, not a rescue. Rayola pulled out victims to pass to Betts, starting with Michael Curtin, the bus driver. Each swam up with two victims and handed them to the Eckerd team. Betts had seen tragic things in the Navy, but he had never actually removed dead people from the water. He decided to hold the victims by the back of their shirts. He didn't want to look at their faces. The Greyhound driver was one of the first victims out. Roselet recalls, he can still remember tying the body to the dive platform on the Eckerd boat. He also tried to avoid looking closely. But Rayola prayed as he looked at each one. He'd held friends in his arms in Vietnam, and he watched as they died. He wanted to pay similar respect to the victims, remembering their humanity, even as he had to use rough treatments to free them from the bus. I'm sorry that I have to do this, he thought. I'll do everything I can to help you get back to your family. It's freaking so good. But so you were talking about being thorough and having to fact check. And also, these guys have to have some level of PTSD from this, even though they want to talk about it. Are you asking them like three times? Can I just get this right? Were you grabbing them by the back of the shirt? Do you have to get hyper specific, double, triple check, even when you're writing about something this jarring and this sort of scarring?
Well, they told me this version of the story a couple of times. You know, at first it was, they were not planning on getting that detailed. And then as they started to go, it just got more, you know, into their memories. But the initial conversations that we had, they didn't want on the record. They weren't sure about me yet. And they weren't sure how much they wanted people to know. And then as we kept going, you know, the story would come up again and again. And so I would just listen every time. And it was the same every time. And so I did like my final call or two to just fact check and make sure that it was good. And I said, you know, I'm going to read this back to you and let me know if this is too much. But this is like what I got from our account. And like, just, is this fact right? Like, you know, were you holding it like this, you know? And it was really emotional. It was a hard time to fact check. You know, there were some tears. It was something where I just let them have space to process it. And then I just made sure that they knew that I was really, really grateful. But especially with something like that, I mean, it's hard enough for them to tell the story. It's hard enough for me to like ask them to be 100% sure that that's what happened. But what would be more uncomfortable is if that went in print and it was wrong.
Right. Right.
So I was like, I'd rather be uncomfortable in this way.
Right. Is it okay for you to cry during interviews?
Oh my gosh, that's a really good question. I don't think I've ever cried during an interview, but I think that if you're crying, it's because you're having like an emotional response, and we're people, right? I mean, before we're journalists, before we're, you know, writers, like we're human beings. And I think like, as long as you're not making it about you, if you're having an honest emotional reaction in your body, I think that that happens sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've cried many times during interviews. It's okay. Well, listen, I'm going to say, so first of all, I found out about you because someone reached out to me and said they saw this story about you, about being a nostalgia reporter, and someone else said she would be interesting. And to my great delight, you could have sucked. Like, you could have been a nostalgia reporter, and they just put you on this eclectic beat because they didn't know what else to do with you, and you screwed up on the cops beat and blah, blah, blah. We'll just throw it here. You're freaking great, man. Great. Like, great, great, great. Awesome writer. And I love the sincerity you bring to it, and I love the authenticity you bring to it, and I feel like you take this job really seriously. And a lot of people kick around younger journalists and say, oh, these people, they're just about, you know, social media hits and likes and all the bullshit. And you seem like an appropriate person for this beat because you actually seem like you were an old journalism soul.
Thank you. That's very, very kind. I do want to say something about social media, though, because I think part of the reason why I'm so good at finding story topics and understanding what people want me to dive into is because I did work on the social media desk before I had this.
Right.
I did not think I wanted to do social media. I'm really glad that I'm not doing social media right now, but so much of, you know, journalism school was learning how to write. And then I just really wanted to work at the Times because I grew up reading the Times, and, you know, in high school they had a teen paper that I got to work for, and I was like, this is the coolest. I want to do this all the time. And every semester I would apply to work there, and they would say, go get more experience doing stuff like the copy. And I was like, well, no, I just want to write about dumb shit and interesting things and weird people. And my senior year, I applied for the social media position because I was doing web development and sort of more of the digital side of things. And I was like, well, this is close enough. And they gave it to me because it was not as desired, I think, as some of the other things. And they were like, we should just finally let her come back. And I spent so much time just in Facebook groups and on Reddit and reading tweets and seeing what worked, and then analyzing the data of okay, well, what are the things that people are sharing? What are people reacting to? What are people talking about? And now I just use all of that to kind of understand our local audience. And I think that there is so much, I think, hate about social media, but audience engagement journalists work so hard. And I have so much respect for all those people that, you know, it sounds shallow, you're just writing tweets all day, but especially with the way that our print product has had less and less of a spread, and the impact that it used to have, just because it's the circulation isn't what it used to be, and the amount of times it goes out is never going to go back to 7 days a week. But those are the people that are on the front lines, being a bridge to the readers and talking with readers and clearing up misconceptions that they have, or helping them out and giving them the information that they need. So I do want to give a shout out to all the folks that are, you know, working in social media and really understanding people. And I think that people, journalists of all ages, should really do a shift on the social media desk and really talk to the person in your newsroom that understands analytics and understands sort of these communities. Most of my job, even though it's reporting on older things or looking at the archives or digging into Florida memory or something like that, I get the ideas, or I talk to people and ask them what they want online. And especially during the pandemic, it's been so helpful. So I just have a giant Google Doc of all these different Facebook groups and communities. And I think that it's really, you know, a good way of getting into this. So I just encourage people to do that. And thank you so much for having me and letting me ramble about this. It's just been so fun to shoot the shit with you. And I don't know, I appreciate it a lot.
I want to thank today's guest, Gabrielle Calise, for joining me on Two Riders Slinging Yang. You can follow Gabrielle on Twitter at Gabrielle Calise and read her work in the Tampa Bay Times. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I make no money for doing this podcast, and I rely on word of mouth. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep riding.